The Monologue.
Homicides continue to plague the city of Tacoma. Not Seattle, which it's also true, but Tacoma. Over the course of just about 72 hours, there were 3 fatal shootings. One a day. The homicide number is now 23 for the year. Last year, they hit a 25-year high.
It's COVID's fault.
In just August and September, there have been so far a total of 8 homicides, which is more than 50% in comparison to the rest of the year. So about half of the year's homicides came in August and September. And obviously people are taking notice.
That's just unacceptable.
It is unacceptable, says Councilmember Robert Toms of Tacoma, who spoke to Q13.
Enough's enough, and we need to do something about it. And I'll be putting money in our upcoming budget discussions to do so.
Oh, okay. But y'all cut the Tacoma PD funding. Now, in fairness, they didn't cut a ton. But they didn't do what they should have done, having just been hit with a record high homicide rate. What you should have done, of course, is put funding into policing. When you see that level of crime, you put money into it, not take money away, even if it's a small number.
We've been below size of an average police force since 2008.
They've got about 16 vacant patrol officer positions right now in the department. 16 in a city that is already understaffed only makes things worse. And yet, as this council member complains, and he's been on the right side of a lot of issues that we've talked about in the last couple months at least, he comes from a city that, just like in Seattle, decided to embrace the language of anti-police activists. You have a mayor and a council that can sometimes speak like the very anti-police activists that are responsible for the situation that the city finds itself in. They have embraced BLM. And that's going to make it harder to recruit cops. That 100% will be difficult to recruit police officers to a department run by people and overseen by people who don't seem very appreciative of the work that they do. Now, what he wants to do, Councilmember Toms, is invest millions of dollars in the department's presence, not just for these officers, but also something called CSOs, community service officers, which is not a very good idea.
Maybe you have a police force that has these CSOs who don't have weapons. I welcome that. I don't think every time someone shows up, they need to have a gun.
So just real quickly, do the people who you're sending into a dangerous situation, do they sign off on this not having a gun thing or no? Do they have a say, or are we just sending them to get beat up?
I think that's fair. But someone needs to show up. And right now we have people that call the police and they don't get a response for 2+ hours. Unacceptable.
It is unacceptable, but that's what happens right now in a state, in a country that doesn't value police officers. You should have been complaining about this, with all due respect. And again, on this point, I don't disagree with him in wanting more police officers there and needing to step up the police presence, because proactive policing cuts down on the likelihood of these kinds of crimes. But he should have been more vocal when the BLM movement overtook this state and this country. While they were shouting ACAB, what were you doing? Were you pushing back, or were you placating these lunatics? Because your colleagues on the council, your colleague in the mayor's office, embraced and still embraces that exact same movement responsible for the problems you now currently reside in.
The interview.
As we told you earlier in the show, the number of murders in the U.S. skyrocketed in 2020. It jumped by nearly 30% over the previous year. This shows the rate has increased to unprecedented levels. In fact, it's the largest spike we've seen in murders nationwide since the 60s, when the FBI started to track the data. I told you why I thought the reality is the way that it is earlier on in the show. Now we hear from a member of law enforcement. Marco Montablanco is the president of the Washington Fraternal Order of Police, and he joins me now. Marco, welcome back to the show. If you could, I'm assuming you were not shocked by the numbers, since you know, your members are living this reality, policing this reality, but what was your big sort of top line takeaway?
You're right, Jason. First of all, thanks for having me. And yes, this is not shocking to us. I mean, we've seen all throughout this country the spike in gun violence and it's in homicides, and it's a great, and it's, and the result of that are many different factors. You know, you're seeing a, you know, this defund the police movement in many major cities throughout this country, as well as, you know, a lack of prosecution by some prosecutors giving these sweetheart deals to consistently to violent repeat felons. And I know we've spoken about this in the past, mm-hmm. but also our judicial system and their failure to hold people accountable by providing them low bail amounts so they can bail out and commit additional crimes.
Or no bail.
Now, when you have these, or no bail, exactly. And when you have these situations occurring, there's no shock that this is the result in these numbers going up. And the only people that this really hurts are our citizens, are our victims in our communities. And what we really need to do is tell these elected officials that enough is enough.
Yeah, and let's be clear, the people within the sort of the big demographic of folks who are impacted here, in a world of defunding the police, in a world where people will proclaim Black Lives Matter, it's the Black community that gets hit disproportionately hard at these types of crimes.
You know, it does. And I'll tell you that, you know, the Washington State Fraternal Police, as well as most of our brothers and sisters throughout this country, have been very consistent that we understand evolutions in our profession are needed. And we are at the table with those, having those discussions and providing professional insight. But we are not talking about the one-time or two-time offenders who are just, mm-hmm. you know, stealing something from a store. We're talking about violent offenders who are committing multiple crimes, and the judicial system is failing our community by letting them out, and where they're continuing to commit more violent crimes. It's just ridiculous.
Well, and you say that the criminal justice system is failing, but with respect, is it failing, or is it now the new design as dictated by certain politicians? Because obviously the reality here in Washington State is much different than in, you know, Texas or Florida or Arizona.
Yes, you're right. And there are certain, you know, whether it's prosecutors or judges, you know, or elected officials that are driving some of this narrative, you know, city councils. But I will tell you that there are many politicians on both sides of the aisle, whether you agree or disagree with them, who are wanting to get this right. And so we will always have those discussions with those politicians that want to sit down and have a fact-based discussion on how to change our, you know, police procedures and how to change our judicial system going forward.
But last question on that. We have about a minute left. You know, can you truly have a productive conversation with politicians who are listening to activists who are wanting to abolish police or fully defund police? I mean, at what point do you say it's not worth the conversation, it's time to focus elsewhere?
Well, you know, there are always going to be, you know, individuals that want to push this negative narrative about defunding the police and taking resources away from police who are just trying to do their jobs and keep their community safe. Those types of politicians, you know, are only doing our citizens a disservice, and our citizens should band together with law enforcement and get these politicians out of office.
I'm with you. My point at this point, I guess, is ignoring the politicians who are ignoring us and focusing instead mm-hmm. on those activists. Let's instead have our conversations with members of the community to your point, vote those politicians out of office. We've seen nothing but horrible policies being passed that impact law enforcement, which then impact all the communities and our safety. So, you know, it's time to step up and actually do something. We've been talking with Marco Montablanco. He is the president of the Washington Fraternal Order of Police. Marco, thank you so much for stopping by. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now this.
The monologue.
I can't quite say I understand the thinking behind Facebook putting on hold their children's version of Instagram. So Facebook owns Instagram. And the story that came out of an investigative series by the Wall Street Journal that we talked about last week. In fact, my Newsweek column was on it last week. This idea that internal studies show that girls who use Instagram, in particular girls, are hit rather hard from a self-esteem standpoint as a result of using it, that they feel even suicidal in some cases. They feel bad about their body image and their self-worth as a result of using Instagram. And at the time, I had said, it doesn't matter if that's what Facebook's product is doing. It matters what you are doing as a parent of a kid. But if the concern is that Instagram that currently exists is hurting kids, why would you then put on hold the development of a kid's version of Instagram that could then at least attempt to address those issues? We know that the data suggests using the, you know, for lack of a better term here, the adult version of Instagram, right? The current version of Instagram that they use, the one that is enjoyed by adults, is also being used by these kids who are then suffering as a consequence. Wouldn't you then lean into the development of a kid's version of Instagram if you cared about this? They said they're putting it on hold as they were exploring the parent-controlled experience. That's how they talk about it. But they got hit hard, not just by this investigation from the Wall Street Journal, but a group of 44 attorneys general in this country, and is a bipartisan group, sent a letter to Mark Zuckerberg saying, please abandon this project. I think that that's a mistake. They should lean in. If you're truly concerned about what the social media app can do to your kids, you should want a children's version that takes all of the concerns into account. The fact of the matter is, you're not going to stop a child from using Instagram. You can do better in counseling them how to use social media in general. You can perhaps limit the amount of use that they get on their phone for Instagram and any other social media channel. But this idea that you're going to stop them totally from using it indicates you have no clue what it is you're talking about when it comes to technology, nor do you understand how kids operate. They will find a way, and it's not that hard. You can get Instagram on a desktop if you want. It's not as easy to navigate, I don't think. But they'll just go there. Or they'll live vicariously through a friend's phone on Instagram. So this doesn't quite make sense. Now, lawmakers have said they also want this to be put on hold because they say it leads to more cyberbullying. You're maybe more vulnerable to online predators when kids use the app. No, not if you're giving parents the control. Now, perhaps they end up putting it on pause because going forward, they didn't think it properly addressed some of the concerns. But again, why would you put it on pause? Why not just develop it in real time? This feels like we're seeing an end to this ultimately in concept. And I think that that is not going to be what's best for children in a world in which it is inevitable that they will use this. And keep in mind, right now, your kid, who maybe is 13, 14, 15 years old, they are on an app right this moment that you have never heard of. They are using an app that you have never heard of. So wouldn't you rather a children's version of an app so that you could be more aware? Because the children's versions of these apps will be targeted towards you to install on their phone and to put in place a set of guidelines that you think as a responsible parent are appropriate for your kid. I'd rather that as a parent.
The interview.
It's no secret that law enforcement agencies across the state have said they will not be enforcing any of the mandates to wear a mask, for example, coming down from Governor Jay Inslee. And yet somehow my next guest finds himself in a little bit of controversy for saying what virtually every other sheriff has been saying. Franklin County Sheriff Jim Raymond posted a letter indicating he's not going to be enforcing the mandate, and bam, he's getting some national attention. Sheriff Raymond joins me now. Sheriff, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
What was the impetus for this letter that you had written?
Well, here for about a month now, in the county here with commissioners' meetings and other public forums, there's been people repeating over and over, Sheriff, enforce the mask laws. My personal safety is at risk. And we just kind of seem to be in a rewind over and over and over again on this topic. So generally, that's what prompted me to write the letter. And I find it amazing that people, continue to believe that there is this mask law out there.
Yeah, there is no law, and that's an important distinction that you make. So go ahead and just remind people what your argument is, mandate versus law.
Well, a mandate is, for example, the governor has a proclamation where he can declare emergencies, and orders coming from that are mandates or directives. The law is the law, and you have to look at the RCW or the Title 9A, and you have to look at the elements of the crime, and then you have to make a decision if there's probable cause there to effect an arrest or make a filing, and then you go forward. It doesn't matter what the crime is, but if you look up RCWs or Title 9As on wearing masks, you aren't going to find any. And that's what I was trying to explain to people before we continued too far down the road. And that, the second piece of that is law enforcement officers, and in particular sheriffs, have to be very leery and make sure that before they arrest anybody or detain anybody, there's probable cause to do so, and that it doesn't fly in the face of their constitutional guarantees when you're doing that.
Well, and I know you know this, but thanks to the new laws passed by the legislature, use of force to make that arrest has to come with a felony.
Generally, yes. Yep. There's no such thing as just cause anymore or reasonable suspicion. It has to go right to probable cause, and that's enough evidence to make a reasonable person believe a crime's been committed, and the person you're about to arrest committed that crime.
Yeah, and there's no crime in this case. It would just be against the mandate, but you don't have the enforcement powers over the specific mandate. If the governor or the legislature, they passed a bill that actually makes this law, the governor signs it into law, would you then actually enforce it?
Yeah, if there is actually a law, a criminal law that says you have to wear a mask, then the answer would be yes. I don't think we're ever going to get there, to be quite honest with you, because that seems to be a little unreasonable. But yes, if there was an RCW, a Title 9A, or an RCW outlining it as a criminal act, then the answer would be yes.
What has the response been locally, maybe out in Pasco, any of parts of Franklin County? What are they saying in response to this letter? I imagine you're going to get your supporters and you're going to get your detractors.
That's right. Yeah, the vast majority are the supporters that understand the letter that was written, with the step-by-steps. But there are some people out there that, believe that the sheriff should bow to the direction of the governor and enforce these mask laws. And some of those people at times can be nasty. Some are threatening to run against me for election and, those type of things. So it just depends on who you're talking to on what day. But I don't know. Me personally, I think a lot of people they must have not paid attention in civics classes or something. Not quite sure what the deal is.
Well, something tells me you don't have to be worrying about a potential challenger if the issue is going to be over whether or not law enforcement should take a larger role in masking, because I'm not entirely sure I even understand what people want. Are you supposed to arrest people who aren't wearing a mask? It's kind of ludicrous. We've been talking, of course, with the sheriff of Franklin County. Thank you so much, Jim Raymond, Sheriff Raymond, for coming on. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Now this.
The Jason Rand Show.
Always glad to see Seattle radio host Jason Rance.
It's always a pleasure to watch you and a pleasure now to host you.
Jason, I just love your coverage of what's been going on in Seattle.
Jason, this is as bad as it gets in America.
Jason Rance, great to see you. Thank you.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Central Washington University sent out their denials of religious accommodations for students to get the vaccine on Friday of last week. This is after the school semester had already begun. And so students now find themselves in a position where they can only get a full refund and request that full refund up until tomorrow. So the students only had 2 business days at the end of this to figure out what they're going to do. It seems like it was intentional. On the part of some students, like Emily McDougall, she finds herself in a really tough spot. She doesn't want to have to give information about vaccines to the school. And she's only got 15 credits left to graduate. She's a senior at CWU, and she joins me now. Emily, welcome to the show.
Hi.
So you got a letter on Friday rejecting your religious accommodation request. Take it from there.
Yeah, so I only have 15 credits left to graduate, like you said, and three of those classes are online, and I don't even need to go to the campus. And so I sent in my exemption form, and they said it was compliant until Friday, right after I had already paid for my classes. They said that it was denied. And so I basically have 2 days, like you said, to figure out what I'm going to do. And as of now, I reached out to my counselors and sent a letter to the dean, and some of my counselors aren't even employed anymore as of this week. So it's really just crazy. Everything is up in the air and nobody knows. And I'm getting emails sent to me from counselors, and then I'll go into the email and said, this email is no longer available. And so it's just, everybody's trying to figure out what to do. And as of now, I'm not going to take the vaccine, but it really throws you in a loop because I'm just a little so close to the finish line.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's just absurd. Yeah. Because you're not even able to do this online. You still would have to be subject to their rules.
Yes. And I think as of October 4th, if I don't have it, I can't even finish fall classes.
Yeah.
So, this doesn't take place in the winter. It just takes place basically now. So.
Okay, so you get this letter. You were thinking that you were going to be given an accommodation. Have you been mm-hmm. given a pass on some of the other vaccines?
Yeah. I'm not anti-vaccine, anti-that. Sure. I've been fully vaccinated in a bunch of different other areas. So, I didn't need an exemption for other vaccines, but I did request one for this. And I have worked with Central as far as not living on campus the first mm-hmm. 2 years and other exemptions, and they have worked with me through those and have taken credits that didn't necessarily need to count. So, I just thought that this would be kind of a similar process, but they, just sent out a letter and just said, nope, sorry.
What does that tell you about the administration, especially on the timeline? It felt like to me that this was done intentionally. They could have let you know that you weren't going to be accommodated before the semester started.
Oh, yeah.
There's some kids who moved in to their dorms just a few days ago.
Yeah, up until literally Friday, everything seemed as if they were going to take it. They sent out emails saying, yep, it's all required. If you would like an exemption, sign this. You know, they set it all up so that you were pretty confident that if you wanted an exemption, you would get one. And they had like a whole site set up for it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything seemed to be going through, but they didn't give you any notice, like Friday, seriously, and money and all of that. Just, I don't know. It just frustrates me. They're using leverage for me specifically. In this case, they're using my time that I've put in up till this point to get all of the credits I've got. They're using the money financially that I've put up to this point to get all of the credits I've got. And the degree, over my head as leverage for me to get this. And I just don't feel comfortable with that. So,
yeah, and you're right not to feel comfortable with that because, and I'm glad you used the word leverage. I think that's exactly what's going on. They're using leverage the same way the state is using leverage over employees saying, hey, if you like the living that you make right now, you like that paycheck that you're getting and general job security working for a state agency, well, we're taking that away if you don't get the shot. I think you're right to call it out for what it is. By the way, we're talking with Emily McDougall, a senior over at CWU. So you're now in a position where, you know, you're feeling pretty confident that you're not going to get the vaccine, which means you have just until tomorrow to put in your request for a full refund.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to drop my classes.
Are you going to do that? Do you think that when it comes down to it, you'll be willing to, you know, sign that waiver that says I'm no longer a student here?
Yeah, I have sent them the email, and it really has put me in a hard position. I was thinking, no, I'm definitely not getting the shot. But when it comes down to the line, it really is kind of a struggle because you're, like, so close to a paper. You've put so many years into it to get this degree. But, yeah, when it comes down to it, I'm not doing that. I am very passionate about my choices and the freedom to do so. So I have let them know that as of Tuesday, if they don't get back to me, then I am dropping my classes.
What did you ask in this email? You're saying they have to get back to you by Tuesday or you'll drop the classes. So what did you ask?
So I said, I'm basically fully online this year. I just got a flat denial and it was not specific, which my exemption request was specific. So I feel that it needed to be addressed the same way that I asked for it. And I just said, if I do not get an exemption or I do not get someone to help me get this exemption, then I am going to drop my classes on Monday. So, yeah, so that was basically, and I said for some a school that prides themselves in diversity of thought and culture, I said that they lacked reverence for philosophical and religious objections.
Good for you. Well, you're not a philosophy major, though, right?
No, but
okay.
I mean,
because you want to be employed. You want to be employed after you get that degree.
Exactly. I mean, and I'm just saying, I have a religious exemption because I have a religious objection. But there are central students who might just not associate with the mm-hmm. religious group who still don't want to get this, and I am on their side as well. So. Yeah.
If you could just explain out, just so people understand, you know, where you're coming from. We've heard folks like you be called an anti-vaxxer, which you're, to your point, you're not anti-vaccine. You've been vaccinated. So what is your religious and philosophical objection in this case?
So just most of it is the timing. I mean, lots of people, I'm a critical thinker. I want to have more evidence. I want to have time to think through projects. And I definitely don't. I object to being forced to do something. Now, our pastor has written out a whole letter saying that biblically, like, we don't have to take certain things. And I know there's, like, cell researches that my uncle objects to sometimes.
Yep. Aborted fetus.
It's all just, yes, exactly. And just things like that. It takes time to research these, and you can't research these in a couple months, let alone 2 days, you know, and just, yeah. So I don't know. It's very confusing. It's all over the place, but I'm definitely not anti-vaccination. I believe vaccination saves lives. And, but just, yeah, the choice needs to be there.
What do you plan on doing once you unenroll or disenroll from CWU? What are you going to do to get those 15 credits back?
Yeah, so this is something I'm researching into. I know that there's other online classes that are fully online, and I'm going to see if I can transfer as many credits as I can to get the degree that I need. And if that doesn't work, then I'm a film major. So I'm just going to try to work my way up in that. I have enough experience, mm-hmm. and I'm working with people, and it's an artistic kind of side of things, so it's not really dependent on science or anything, and I'm just going to try to see where that takes me. So that's my plan as of 2 days ago.
Best of luck, Emily, with whatever ends up happening. I think what CWU is doing here is atrocious. You're not the only one who's in this tough spot. In fact, throughout the week, we'll be talking with others who are facing a similar case than you, and we've reached out to CWU for some answers. They've got until 20 minutes from now to get back to me, and once we get those answers, we'll be delivering them on air. Until then, Emily McDougall, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Absolutely. You're listening to The Jason Rand Show. Now this.
The Jason Rand Show.
Jason Rantz, Seattle radio host, joins us now.
Jason, you're the perfect guest on this.
Jason Rantz, welcome back, Jason.
I see you often on other programs here.
Jason, what's going on?
Jason, thanks for coming on.
The Quick Hit.
There was a podcast put out by The New Yorker, and I don't normally talk about The New Yorker because it's an insufferable magazine created by people who think they're much smarter than you, and perhaps they are, but you don't always have to write in a way that basically says underneath the byline, written by a dude who's way smarter than you. And I'm going to test your patience by writing excessively long stories about things that are marginally interesting that I make very much less so as a result of the novella that I've just written. But they've done a podcast, and I don't normally listen to the podcast because my assumption is it's going to be as insufferable as the actual newspaper or magazine. But in this case, I wanted to play a quick clip because their podcast host, David Remick, interviewed a dude named Andreas Malm. And in this, they talk about the environmentalist movement and what needs to be done in order to see some significant change. Now, oftentimes, the movement has been about getting rid of oil or a dependence on oil. Some of it has to do with environmental issues that could impact wildlife, but it's generally been centered around a bunch of people getting together in groups and yelling and sometimes throwing fake blood and sometimes getting in the way of a business opening. But according to this guest, Andreas Malm, it should be a little bit more extreme. He's based in Sweden. He's actually a human ecology professor over at Lund University. But he wrote a book called How to Blow Up a Pipeline, Learning to Fight in a World on Fire. Now, that is not a metaphor, even though most of us might think, oh, that he's obviously kidding. He's using some specific language as a way to gain some attention and speak more metaphorically. But like, no, he means it quite literally.
So I am in favor of destroying machines, property, not harming people. That's a very, very important distinction there. And I think property can be destroyed in all manner of ways, or it can be neutralized in a very gentle fashion, as when we deflated the SUVs, or in a more spectacular fashion, as in potentially blowing up a pipeline that's under construction. That's something that people have done.
It is, and it's a crime for a reason, because no matter what you think you're doing here is safe towards a human being that you don't see around, it could still kill a human you're unaware is around. But number two, this idea that property destruction is some sort of moral imperative is not new to the environmentalist movement. He's made the point there in that clip, and he makes the point in his book. But we've seen more and more and more of this coming from folks on the left leaning in to this kind of terrorism as a means to some kind of social justice. They believe that what they're doing is for a good cause. They believe that fighting for the environment is a moral imperative, the same way that BLM activists and Antifa thugs think that what they do is morally just. And when you think something is morally just, if you think you're saving lives, you might be willing to turn to violence. And this idea that it just stops at property crime, oh, yeah, we will destroy machines, but not people. To think that that's where it stops is incredibly naive, because you have folks who do things that are thoughtless. And as I saw this story and Mediaite picked it up and some others called it out as well, I immediately thought of a story we covered here on this show just 2 weeks ago, a story that for the most part, even locally, hasn't gotten that much attention, but nationally you would think it would. You had two girls who were arrested for a domestic act of terrorism up in Bellingham, or down, depending on where it is you live. For all my Blaine listeners, you have two girls. One of them pleaded guilty. The other one was found guilty of putting a shunt on the railroad that oftentimes delivers crude oil on trains between Seattle and Canada and into Canada. Now, putting a shunt, which disrupts the electrical wiring, or the electrical pulses on a track, could lead to a derailment. That obviously can lead to death, lots of it. And not to mention spilled crude oil. So one was found guilty, one was convinced to plead guilty for a lighter sentence, and I believe they face up to 20 years in jail, at least. The plea deal, I think, got a little bit less than that, or will. This is not the direction that we want to go in, so this is not just some freak from Sweden who's making this point. We're already seeing this be deployed. We had a summer of love in which we saw violent destruction and death. But somehow we're supposed to think that this isn't all that bad of an idea, or it's interesting enough that we should have conversations about it. Should we? Should we give people like this a microphone? Should we? I mean, we have the right to do it. It's not about rights. He has the right to hold these horrible positions, even though, by the way, he's not American. He's based in Sweden. I don't know what the laws say there. I'm assuming he's comfortable with it if he's doing it. But anyone can justify an action, right? A Nazi could justify an action. They did. White supremacists justify their violence. Black supremacists justify their violence. Supremacists in general can justify their violence. Just because they justify doesn't mean it's right. Because you and I look at that stuff and say, well, you might justify it, but we don't because we're not insane people. Well, insane people can justify just about anything. We could all justify something. That's why we have a general set of rules that we as a society have agreed to abide by. And so it drives me nuts that we're amplifying voices like this and not just calling it out as what it is. Lunatic, fringe, nonsense that should be shunned, not embraced.
The Last Rant.
Speaking of shunned and not embraced, can we talk just briefly about Facebook, the worst service ever? This is of all the social media sites, this is the worst. Not because of the way it's designed from an aesthetic perspective, meaning the algorithms they use to put content in front of you. But they're so buggy. And while I know this impacts virtually no one, it's called The Last Rants, not The Last whatever your name is. So I'm going to jump into it for just about 30, 40 seconds in hopes that someone out there either works for Facebook or knows someone who works for Facebook. Y'all have an app for the business page, of which I have a profile because of the Jason Rant Show profile on Facebook, facebook.com/Jason Rant Show, that does not work. The app does not work. Things that used to work do not work. Things that never work still do not work. And yet, they are still part of the app. Inviting people to like the page does not work. Scheduling things sometimes do not work. Going to past posts do not work. You get an error screen. How is it possible that a business as big as Facebook can't figure out basic functionality on an app? And haven't been able to for years. How is that possible? It is driving me nuts. I use it because I have to. It helps me get some of the content out there. They're just making it much more difficult for me to do that. Not because the system doesn't make sense from a design perspective of trying to figure out where to go. It's because when you figure out where to go, it doesn't work. So fix it. Thank you. That's all. And that's The Last Rants.